Bringing up the issue with regard to the construction of the Mishkan, specifically that very prominently is the use of gold, that the vessels had to be covered in gold. And the question is being raised, I suppose you could ask it in a general way, that the physical appearance of the Mishkan, and later on, the Mishkan really becomes the Beit HaMikdash when it becomes permanent, has great importance, has great significance. Now, what's the question? All right, so what? You know, let's get the question more and more precise. David, let's get the question more precise. So, gold. So, what's wrong with gold? You mean to say that it's contradictory? There's a contradiction that, in general, we don't emphasize the physical beauty.
Right.
Yeah?
Yeah.
So you're saying it could be simple. Huh?
Yeah.
Yeah, you know, is there any way to make the question a little bit stronger? I always like to, you know.
But in the physical, we go away from the physical.
Right.
It is? Right. Ribui Kesef. Right? Yeah. Chesed v'zav. For example, I'll just state the question in a general way as I understand it. And that is that it seems that the general idea of Yadus is that a person, in order to achieve perfection, has to wean himself away from the attraction to the materialistic world. Attraction to the materialistic world expressed itself in different ways, so as well to say. Everybody has a psychological attraction to wealth. And then there's, within that framework, there's different manifestations, beauty, art, great architecture, all of these things. You see a expression of the idea that there is a problem with being in great architectural design.
Mm-hmm.
For example, you see that in the story of the Tower of Babel, that there's a very powerful emotion to express the sense of egotism, of human greatness, through structures. And, you know, different societies that are affected by this sense. Empires, they want to create an empire, and they're involved in this glorification of itself. What's that, my phone?
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's funny.
In general, all of these societies that are involved in this glorification, the glorification of man really has a lot to do with the artistic element in man. The artistic element itself breaks down into different forms. Great art. You see that there's this element of deification. Because even today, you have great artists, you have great paintings, but the amount of money that they can fetch, in my opinion, are absolutely absurd. Millions and millions of dollars, that's a different type of an evaluation. There's nothing inherently in it that can make it worth that much. It's a tremendous contradiction. Of course, they'll all go on and on about how beautiful and this and that, whatever it is. They can't. It becomes like a religious thing. Like there's a worship over there. They're worshiping something because they really can't express what exactly. Concretely speaking, what do you see in this picture? Take the greatest painting, a Mona Lisa, whatever it is. I'm not an expert in art. Whatever it is, I'm sure it's good or whatever it is. There may be some meaning in it, but express to me what you find in that is worth millions and millions of dollars. I don't think anyone that pays that kind of money can do so. I understand, I'm not talking from the standpoint that a lot of people will pay the money because what's the difference? It has that work, so it's a business, an investment. I'm not talking about that. But the fact that it can achieve that kind of a value shows that people are projecting something onto it. There is an element of worship. The truth of the matter is, if you get a a great book which has ideas, philosophy, truth, and so forth, which is worth infinitely more than the greatest painting, and you can get that for $10 or $15, whatever. So there's a complete absurdity over here. There's also the expression of, but that to me is an example, that the value there has to do with this sense, with this desire to glorify man and the works of man's hands. Lo nomaro delokeinu lamasa yadeinu. We will no longer deify the works of our hands. So the deification of art, the works of man's hands, that's something that the Torah is opposed to. That's a concept that the Torah recognizes. That's why you don't have any real tradition. It's interesting, in Yadav, you don't have, even in a cultural, certainly not in the framework of the Torah, but even on a cultural level, we were never a people that glorified art, that glorified architecture, that glorified all the things that the other society, like the Greek society, glorified great architecture, great structures, because that was a hedonistic, ego-centered society. And yet you see, in the Beis HaMikdash, the element of the artistic is very significant. That he chooses people like Bezalel that had this type of a chachma. It's a type of chachma. They had chachma, but they were skilled artisans. And here, there's a tremendous emphasis. You know, a few parshios describe the planning, the structure, the building, and then the utilization of gold. And here it seems that the Torah is putting a tremendous amount of stock into the elements of the physical. Of physical beauty, the beauty of the design, the beauty of the structure, and so on and so forth. So it seems to be a departure from the general idea of Yadav, that the physical is just a means to an end. We shouldn't put emphasis in the physical. We shouldn't look at the physical as something to be cultivated and valued in its own right. That's a very, very significant point. That's one of the... It's not the only one, but it's a major point of departure between Yadav and the other philosophies. All right, that's the question? Is that a good expression of the question?
Yeah.
Okay, good. Very good. Now I'll consider some of your approaches.
You have one
other
time?
No?
Ravi?
Yes.
I was thinking it could be similar to the Rambam's idea on Karbonos. Maybe that a person should take this idea of glorification and focus it on the appropriate things. That all this gold and all this nice architecture is relegated into a halakhic system. It has to be done exactly this way. And that'll place the...
Let me make it clear. The idea, it seems to me, the idea by the Rambam has by Karbonos, I think suggested that perhaps the approach that Torah is using over here is similar to the way the Rambam describes the purpose of Karbonos, where the Rambam in the Morah, his position seems to be that the Torah did not include Karbonos because that is the ideal way in which a person should relate to God. And he says that there are certain things that given the way the world is, given the way the situation is, that become impossible. When we say impossible over here, we mean impossible according to the ordinary state of things. Of course, if God wanted to change that, from a miraculous standpoint, God could. But what we're learning is that that's not the way God relates to the creation. So that, according to the Rambam, it's a controversial idea, and it's interesting. We could take this up at a different time. Be machlokas. Big argument about Karbonos. And that is that the Rambam's idea is that it does not represent the ideal. And if, in a perfect situation, the Torah would not have included Karbonos. That is not the ideal way to relate to God. And according to him, of course, the question arises, so why did the Torah include Karbonos? This is the ideal system. It's the perfect system. So, with the Rambam is a very fascinating chapter. It's a good idea, by the way, to read it through in anticipation of a discussion, a more detailed discussion. Is that you know, the Torah relates to man, I guess in a sense, by Sharushom. And that's not the, I'm just using that as a illustration and then the level that he's at. That's the way mankind was. That's the way the Jewish people were at that point in time. The certain practices had taken hold of the people. And he gives that illustration. That is to say that just like it would be impossible, he said, his time, to begin a new religious system and say we should just worship God through ideas, through understanding, through knowledge, and not have certain practices like tefillah, like prayer, or like fasting and the like, he's saying that they just wouldn't take hold. The people couldn't relate to that. And he said, by the way, he doesn't mean to equate tefillah, prayer, and fasting and whatever he lists over there. He doesn't want to equate it to sacrifices because he says that those activities are closer to the objective, so to speak. But he's just using it as an illustration that in order to have a system, a religious system, people have to have certain activities that they associate with religious behavior, with religious practice. He's saying the same is true if you go back in time when the Torah was given. The idea of starting a religion and relating to God without sacrifices would have been something that people couldn't comprehend. That's how deeply entrenched that idea was. And therefore, it would have been futile to propound a religion, to give them a religion, and it didn't include any outlet for the need to have sacrifices. But you see, it's interesting, this does tie into the whole idea of the Mishkan, by the way. Because on the basis of this premise, the Rambam explains many, many things about the whole system of sacrifices. And treating it from the standpoint that there's an inherent ambivalency. Now, on the one hand, the Torah couldn't negate sacrifices. On the other hand, it contains a very significant danger and can lead people astray. And you do see that throughout the history of the Bayis Rishon, that there was a tremendous amount of difficulty or corruption can be brought into play once you have a system of sacrifices. Not the least of which is that people begin to look at the sacrifice as being an automatic kapara, so to speak. It becomes a safety net for people that want to do avera. The person does an avera, and then he doesn't have the correct idea that the sacrifice itself does not really produce anything. It's just the intention. It's an expression of the intention. This is one of the major things of the Nevi'im in the Bayis Rishon. God is saying, what do I need all your sacrifices for? And that's by the case of Shaul as well. That Shmuel rebukes him. That God don't need, because Shaul's excuse was that he spared the animals because he wanted to use them for sacrifices. He said, do I need your sacrifices? What I really need is that you should listen and to do the correct thing. Yeah, but at the same time, we do have sacrifices. So it means to say that the essence of the carbon is to be a means. It's a means to an end. It's acting out certain ideas to bring home to a person in a very concrete way certain truths. But if you don't have that element, and which you can see that people can very easily slip away from the ideal and descend, regress, to the level where the sacrifice becomes a thing in itself. You can see that happening in old times. You see it in our own times, where the activity becomes the end in itself. And it sort of becomes a mystical kind of a thing. And many people look at that with the mitzvah. That is to say that they don't look to the mitzvah as something which instructs them, from which you derive knowledge and understanding, but rather it's the performance per se in a certain mystical quality. And when that happens with regard to carbon, so it's a big problem. Because then, that's it, you sort of, you have a safety net. So you can more or less do whatever you want to do. You can behave any way you want to behave. Mm-hmm. And then you just bring your carbonos. And you feel very secure. Okay? Now, the Rambam, on the basis of his explanation, that there's a certain ambivalency, so you can understand why there was this concept of centralization. Everything becomes focused around the Beit HaMikdash. Once the Beit HaMikdash was established, so then there was a prohibition against the bamos, that private, private places, private altars, they couldn't bring karbanos. It's the history of the Arayis to bring karbanos outside of the Beit HaMikdash, once the Beit HaMikdash is established. And that, on the basis of this concept, I mean, it's a major pivot, because so many different ideas fall into place, I mean, according to the Rambam. If you disagree with the Rambam, so you'll have to account for these things in a different way. For example, the fact that not everybody could bring karbanos, that it has to be only the Kohanim. Because if you recognize that it contains a danger, this is not something which is left in the hands of ordinary people. The Kohanim are set aside, ideally, that they're the ones who occupy themselves with study, with knowledge, with understanding, so it's in their hands. But it can't be in the hands of just anybody. Also the fact that there are so many restrictions in terms of tumah, that a person can't participate, can't enter the Beit HaMikdash in a state of tumah. There's many, many things built into the system which have the purpose of kind of discouraging or limiting it so that it should not become rampant and widespread. But it's there. It exists. So it's sort of like a compromise kind of formulation. Hold on a second. Why did I get into this? Just to help me out here. I'm forgetting the trend.
Oh, because David brought up karbanos to as a demonstration. You answered it. That's what he. Yeah.
David, what?
I wanted to try to tie that into the fact that they use.
I was just explaining, amplifying your point.
Yeah.
No. Now, having set that up, I want to see whether it follows. One second. Okay. Yeah, I went into. All right. Let me just finish the point. Because I get caught up on the point. Let me just finish the point. But the Rambam's basic idea, though, that the Torah did incorporate karbanos. The problem, however, was that when the people brought karbanos, it was a negative thing. It was tied up with false ideas about God and how to relate to God. So that was the problem. But the solution was not to ban karbanos altogether, because that would have been impossible in terms of the state of the people, that they couldn't embrace a religion which did not give them the possibility of karbanos. However, what the Torah did was, this is the infinite wisdom of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, that the Torah incorporated it, but it associated it with all of the correct ideas. So it's sort of it's designed to secure the person of the false ideas. That's interesting, that you work with the person, you work with the things that the person is accustomed to, and except you associate it now with correct ideas. So in the course of going through Karvan, he's going to encounter a certain emotions, a certain premises, he's going to see that they don't make sense, and he's going to have to correct them and redirect them. So the truth of the matter is that it can be utilized for positive purposes. That's his idea. To cure us of the false ideas, the Torah retained the system of karbanos and utilized it to cure us of false ideas that had accumulated it, but we're using that very same system because it's become so entrenched in people's behavior that it would be impossible to work without it. However, at the same time, obviously, there's got to be all these transformations to infuse the system with correct ideas. Okay? Alright. Now, what does that have to do with the gold and the silver? Is that true that the Torah is using this? Is that the same thing? That the Torah now decided that there's an opportunity to free us of our attachment to gold and silver?
Right. It's a slightly different idea. That by karbanos, it's taking that emotion of the inappropriate way of serving God or the emotion of serving deities and putting that in the right format and the right framework. Here it's more like, I guess, like we were saying about the deification of man, that the person thinks he's so great when he makes all these great architectural things. So it would be taking that thing and focusing it on the correct thing, that person would be focused on these things that represent the correct philosophical ideas.
I hear you. whether the same concept can help us in terms of understanding the emphasis on the beauty of the structure, the design, and the materials in the building of the Mishkan, which would seem to be contrary to the Jewish ideal. I mean, what would the Torah say? I mean, let's say in Israel today or whatever, the building of a beautiful structure. It's interesting, there's no halacha. I mean, there's nothing halachically wrong with building these things. I guess it would be a philosophical phenomenon. Yeah. It would be wrong.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right.
Like a World Trade Center kind of thing.
Right.
The whole idea of rebuilding the world. You see that the idea of the World Trade Center, you see that it's not just a functional phenomenon. You see it's a statement. Yeah. Why? Because now there's a whole debate as to what to do there.
Yeah, they want to make it the tallest structure in the world now.
Yeah, the tallest structure, whatever, yeah. I mean, well, look, it's practically speaking, so it may not be such a good idea now. So, but the idea of, you see, it's a psychological thing. You can't just dispense with it. They have to rebuild it. Yeah. I guess that would be wrong. Well, there's a lot of things in Israel that we wouldn't, right? But the whole idea of the Olympics.
Right.
Yeah, you heard me explain that, right?
Yeah.
No, what?
When did I explain that?
Probably last year. The Olympics were last year.
Yeah, that is contrary to the philosophy of Yehuda.
Yeah.
Because it's the glorification. Two things I said. Right. I mean, I hope we have notes of this, okay? I don't remember what I said, but there were two things wrong we said. It's the glorification of the of man, that's basically what it's about, and glorification of man on the basis of something which doesn't really represent man. That's the animalistic part. It's not even in the true realm, which would be the intellectual realm. One should not glorify man as being, you know, a great thinker or a great genius. That's still the glorification of man, but at least it's in the correct realm. Here, it's two things. Glorification of man, it's not even really man. It's a falsification of man. Yeah. So I said that would be, if I was the prime minister, I would not have an Olympic team. But there is no Israeli entity that should be there. We don't join together with the nations anyway. This is how I'm going on. That's a separate concept. Okay, the concept over here seems to me, with regard to the way the Mishkan was structured, and those aspects of physical beauty which normally would be discouraged in other areas. It seems to me that it may be similarity with the Rambam's idea about the inclusion of carbon, even though it's not the ideal. But I don't know that it's identical. It's not necessarily a curative to cure us from our attachment to the physical. That's a much more complex thing, because that you're involved in your day-to-day. That's not something, for example, carbon is something that can only be done in conjunction with the Beit HaMikdash and so forth. But the struggle to free oneself from the attachment to the material, that's a much more consuming type of a thing. That's something that's it's part of a person's perfection. However, with regard to the idea of building structures, which we said partakes of this idea of the formation of bands, again, you can see that there are two levels. There are two falsifications. Interestingly enough, as I expressed with regard to my opposition to Israel participating in the Olympics, that the Olympics is a false idea because it has to do with the glorification of man, a sense of human greatness. False idea. Second false idea is that that's really man. This is not the essence of man. This is depicting man in terms of his physical prowess. It's an animalistic phenomenon. find the real uniqueness of man is with regard to the Tzelem HaLokim, the divine image, and his ability to understand and to perfect himself. Here, too, the idea of the deification is in terms of these architectural structures. And secondly, this again is not the essence of man. The ability to the artistic element of man. The artistic element of man, I would say, probably is closer to the intellectual aspect, but it's still an artistic. It has to do with his imagination, with his emotions, and so forth. However, the idea that the Mishkan should be built this way, should have the beauty, should have the beautiful structure and all of that, is a very important idea. Because there's no question we have to understand human nature. And a person is affected by the nature of a structure. That's why it's prohibited to go inside of a church. But certainly a church which is built in a magnificent kind of a way, architecturally and the design and the windows and so forth, it does create in a person a certain sense of awe. And that's precisely why it's prohibited. Because this is a very, very powerful force. And that's associated. Once you partake of things that have a sense of magnificence, or even these, the church music, all different types of concertos, etc., whatever, all this type of thing, or these cathedrals, these beautiful cathedrals, all of these things produce a certain effect upon a person. Of grandeur. And the danger is that he'll always associate it with something. There's always that association. So if it's ordinary, if it's a secular phenomenon, then essentially the grandeur of man's great. That's what a person, any type of thing like that, like the Golden Gate Bridge, or these different types of structures, produce a certain sense of awe. Because it gives the person a sense that this is beyond. This is like beyond the natural, like a certain supernatural control. If you encounter it and you go to a church service and you have the sense of that awe and that beauty, so then it's going to corrupt you because it's something that's happening that's outside of your control. The associative. You're making an association. Whether it's conscious, whether it's unconscious, it's going to cause you to have a different attitude towards the source of all this, towards Christianity, towards this. And even though there's absolutely no reality, that the system can be the most corrupt in terms of pure ideas, nevertheless, the most corrupt system can produce that which is superficially the most appealing and most pleasant to the senses. That's the basis, by the way, why a person is not permitted to derive any enjoyment from anything having to do with Avodah Zarah. Why you're not allowed to listen to the church music, or to admire the architecture, to admire the church art, to derive any benefit, because there's a certain association between the two. It's sort of like shochad. That's the idea of shochad, of bribery. And you see how machzid, the Torah is very demanding, that a judge, even if you do the slightest favor for the judge, he has to recuse himself. Why? Because unconsciously he's already predisposed towards you in a certain positive way, and that will have an effect upon his opinion. So you're good, you're right. That, I think, is the idea, that the Torah, in terms of the Mishkan, the beautification of the Mishkan, is based upon the fact that, A, that's not to be found anywhere else. The objective is achieved by not having that anywhere else. So therefore, we don't engage in the deification of man through the cultivation of architectural structures. Because if you were to do that, then it would detract from the effect of the Mishkan. That basically the way we live our lives is in line with the true idea that the structure that you live in is purely for one purpose, for habitation, for providing a protection, and that's it. So you have a mezuzah on the house, and you're not to make the house into something other than that. To build it up and to create the sense that this is something permanent and this is something magnificent. You're not supposed to do that. However, when it comes to the Beit HaMikdash, that's the place where all the emotions have to be brought into play. That when it comes to the true ideas, the proper way of serving God, of course, is through the mind, but it has to really engage the whole spectrum, all of the various emotions of man. That's why, for example, you have Shiva, you have the musical instrument, only in the Beit HaMikdash. We don't, again, our culture doesn't really emphasize the music, the development of music, and so on and so forth. Because when it comes to Avodas Hashem, it's got to be something which engages the person at every possible level. Because here it's associated with the true ideas, with the true concepts of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. That's where all God did implant all of these emotions within us, and they're very, very important. And a person should not repress those emotions when they're in the proper context. Should not prevent himself from experiencing a certain awe in the presence of a Kadosh Baruch Hu. That's very, very important. The sense of awe, the sense of majesty. It's not just an intellectual idea, but it's something which should be experienced. And that's why, when it comes to the Mikdash has to be built, must be designed, in a manner which evokes the appropriate sense of awe. The appropriate sense of awe is part of the Avodah Hashem. And if we just make the Mikdash in a simplistic way, which did not have any impact upon the psyche and evoke all of these emotions, would be wrong. I mean, I guess we're like just abstract philosophers and so forth, but even there, it's not enough, because even they have to be affected by this sense of awe and yira. That's a very important thing in part of Avodas Hashem. So that's why, and that perhaps is an opening as to the extent to which the Torah describes the building, the construction of the Mishkan, is, because otherwise, in general, the question is, why does the Torah devote so much space to going into all the particularities? And I'm not saying I'm giving a complete answer over here, I'm just suggesting something. And that is that the Mishkan is more than just a place for an activity. If that were the case, it's just, that's a practical thing, whatever. You have a Sanhedrin, so you have to have a place where the Sanhedrin meets. But there's no need to go into all the details in terms of constructing it. That's a different kind of a thing. That's just an activity. That's a functional phenomenon. The Mikdash is more than just a functional phenomenon. And interestingly enough, I mean, you see that the whole idea of Shalosh Pam Mashana Yeroa Olzachurva is the idea of the Iya. That you come to see Espanay Hashem, of course not literally, to see God, so to speak, and to be seen. To come into the presence of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Right, with Karbanos and all of that, but that is an experience. I mean to say that three times a year a person is supposed to go through a certain type of an experience, which contains the bringing of Karban, which contains certain mitzvot, which contains being in Yerushalayim, but he has to be present in the Beit HaMikdash. So it means to say that it's designed as a place where a person can experience a certain type of an awe in the presence of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, which is vital for that person. So I would say that that's why, when it comes to this area, to the contrary, you're supposed to utilize all of those things that God created. See, all the things that God created have a purpose. And the purpose, of course, is Avodas Hashem. Everything finds its fulfillment in Avodah Hashem. That's the whole purpose of Adam. That's the whole purpose of the physical creation. Now, all of these different things, you see, are designed and are amenable to Avodah. Since that's the case, if a person has the false idea and utilizes it for the for the deification of Adam, so that that's why they build these tremendous towers, to glorify their own civilization. And the Torah, of course, is absolutely opposed to that. But it's not opposed to the underlying concept that these things do serve that purpose. However, they can be utilized in a very, very careful way, and to be associated with that place which represents China. That, I think, it could not be done any other way. To be done any other way would be deficient, would prevent you from gaining the ultimate purpose. The ultimate purpose is to have a certain type of an experience which evokes every one of those emotions in man and redirects them towards the truth. That's the perfection of Adam. Perfection of Adam is not simply by being an abstract philosopher, but to be a philosopher whose ideas are entrenched and make an impact upon all of the various emotions that he has. A kolach mosai tomarna, all my bones will declare Hashem Michamocha. Who is like unto you, O Lord? Okay, I'm ready to make my sermon tomorrow.
All right. Beautiful. Really nice.
Okay. Yeah. All right, shout to you guys. As I said, I have a sermon for tomorrow, but no, but I think it's a good idea. I'm glad we did it.
Thanks, Rabbi.
Thank you.
Have a good Shabbos.
Good Shabbos, Rabbi.
Okay.